I think it's time to start. I know it's really exciting to be able to be here today for me. I would like to welcome everyone to the Middle East Center at St. Anthony's. We're very excited today because we have Professor Malika Zeghal, and she is here to discuss her latest book that has just come out in the UK on the 21st of May, if I'm not mistaken. And the title of her book is The Making of the Modern Muslim State, Islam and Governance in the Middle East and North Africa. The book is published by Princeton University Press, and you have the code, and it's you can get a 30% discount, which is fantastic. So please let us know if you would like to find out more about the code. Professor Zeghal is Prince Al-Walid bin Talal Professor in Contemporary Islamic Thought and Life in the Department of the Near Eastern Languages and Civilization at Harvard University. She has published numerous books and articles on Islam and politics. They include a book published by Sciences Po on the ulama of Al-Azhar, and I think, you know, that's definitely, and you've also published an article in Ijmis about this book, a variation [S2] Yes. [S1] of the book. It's an excellent article. I've learned so much from that article. In fact, I think I've used your article in my teaching as well as when I was doing my PhD. I was so excited to refer to that article. I'm a big fan of Professor Zeghal's work, as you can tell, so this is really exciting for me. She's also the author of Islamism in Morocco, Religion, Authoritarianism, and Electoral Politics. And like everyone else, I'm thrilled to have you here. Thank you so much for coming and for visiting us. We feel so lucky that you're here with us today. And without further delay, I invite Professor Zeghal to discuss her book.
Well, thank you so much for this very kind introduction. Thank you, Raihan, for inviting me. I want to also thank you, Jean Rogan, for inviting me to present my book here at the Middle East Center. I am delighted and honored. I would also like to thank Caroline Davis for organizing this event and my travel to come here. Thank you all for being here. There are some friends in this room that I'm delighted to see and have supported me over the years, and I am grateful. Okay, so the questions I ask in the book are the following. First, how has the role of Islam in governance been conceived in the Middle East and North Africa in the modern period? By modern period, I mean a strictly chronological period, that is the 19th to the 21st centuries. Second, how has it been implemented in concrete terms? By concrete, I also mean material terms. And third, what may have changed from pre-modern times? So how do I respond to these questions in the book? I find that in continuity with the past, in modern times, the state is generally expected to be the custodian of Islam as the preferred religion. This means that one of its duties is to preserve the religion that is Islam, the Muslim community, and Islamic institutions. The first principle is the preservation of the religion, for example, by guaranteeing worship, the celebration of Muslim holidays, or the organization of the pilgrimage, but also by disseminating and enforcing specific interpretations of Islam or limiting freedom of expression. The second principle is the preservation of the Muslim community, for example, by defending its borders or shoring it up against erosion through forbidding or preventing Muslims' conversions. Third is the preservation of Islamic institutions, for example, by upholding Islamic courts or funding Islamic education and places of worship. I show that this duty is tied to sovereignty, even if exercised by a non-Muslim ruler. For instance, as I show in chapter 2, in French-occupied Tunisia, some Tunisians asked what they and French authorities called Islamic France to be the custodian of Islam. In fact, in the 1920s, there were three competing custodians of Islam in Tunisia: Islamic France, the Tunisian monarch, the Bey, and a sovereign independent Tunisia. The state that was exercising sovereignty or aspiring to exercise it was expected to be the custodian of Islam. Moreover, this duty is only one of the state's duties, and it is performed through a state partnership with the ulama. This partnership has endured, notwithstanding fluctuations in the relative strength of any of the partners, in its institutional forms, and in the vocabulary used to designate it. This does not mean that the state does not protect other religions, only that Islam is protected more than the others. It does not mean that there are no domains of equality between Muslims and non-Muslims. In fact, we do find such domains in modern and pre-modern times. And it does not mean that religious and political authority are necessarily conflated. They may or may not be. But it implies that we generally find no separation between Islam and the state, and no state neutrality toward religions as an aspiration or concrete reality. But sometimes we find aspirations to separate Islam and politics. This has created some confusion in the literature, which argues on that basis that such states are secular. However, separating Islam and politics often serves to ensure a state monopoly on religious affairs, and sometimes keep at bay the political ambitions of the religious minorities as such, to ensure that the state remains Muslim. In the book, I retrace the continuity of the state custodianship of Islam, SCI for short, in the midst of two transformations. One was the importation of new techniques of governance, which was not unprecedented. Indeed, there have been significant changes to techniques of governance before the 19th century reforms. The advent of the Tanzimat in the 19th century should not obfuscate earlier series of reforms or attempts to reform. However, the importation of constitutions as an institutional form was new. The other transformation was the expansion of the size and reach of the state from the 19th to the 21st century, which was truly unprecedented in its magnitude. So I find that there has been a broad agreement across the political spectrum on the necessity of the state custodianship of Islam as the preferred religion, but also, and this is particularly important for my argument, vigorous debates about its meaning and extent. By attending to the long history of these debates, we can make legible the political cleavage about the role of Islam in governance in the modern Middle East. I want to add important points about this broad agreement. The state custodianship of Islam is an empirical regularity, not an essential feature, and not inevitable. There are several exceptions among Muslim-majority countries around the world, albeit only one in the Middle East today, Lebanon, which is particularly religiously fragmented, and I will say a few words later about it. I do not argue that Islam is an inherently political religion, or more political than other religions, or that the political in Muslim states is inherently or predominantly religious. In fact, I provide a quantitative evaluation of the well-bounded domain of state involvement in religion, public religious expenditures relative to non-religious ones in modern but also pre-modern times, which shows just the opposite. I also do not make predictions as to whether the expectation that the state is or be the custodian of Islam as a preferred religion will continue to be prevalent in most Muslim majority polities, in the future, its historical persistence notwithstanding. I argue that it has been a matter of choice, vigorously discussed as to its meaning and extent. In fact, this choice has been made in the modern period, in full awareness of the wide array of alternative potential options as to the role of religion in governance. Different choices could therefore be made in the future. I also find that some voices call or have called for a change in this respect, although they are rare and seldom express themselves in formal deliberative arenas. This reinforces the fact that what is prevalent today as far as the role of Islam in governance is concerned, is by no means ineluctable. Since there is a broad agreement about the state custodianship of Islam and debates about its meaning and extent, There is a political cleavage about it. I find that it is organized around four interrelated recurring questions. First, the thickness of the state custodianship of Islam, that is, the extent to which Islamic principles constrain the state. It is the commitment of the state to Islamic principles in governance, e.g. in legislation, or as a philosophy of governance. For instance, to call for the implementation of Sharia law is to call for a thicker state custodianship of Islam. Second, the munificence of the state custodianship of Islam, that is the extent of public religious provisions that the state should make available to Muslims, e.g. mosques, imams, Islamic education, Islamic courts and personnel, Islamic forms of public assistance. It is the state's commitment to Islam from a material point of view. Third, there is the strength of the state custodianship of Islam, that is the extent to which the state should constrain Islam and its institutions with its coercive and pedagogical apparatus, e.g. by imposing its own interpretations of Islam. And finally, there is the relationship between religion and politics. That is the issue of who can partake in implementing and discussing the state's custodianship of Islam, e.g. should the ulama engage with politics? For example, when speaking truth to power and criticizing the ruler for not fulfilling his duty to protect the religion, the community, or its institutions. Also, can political competition be organized alongside sectarian lines? Or can political activism be based on religion? Can mosques serve as fora for political deliberations and competition? This categorization, these four questions, help make the debates about the role of Islam in governance legible and follow it through time. It helps separate what these debates owe to historical contingencies from what they owe to the persistence of core principles and questions. In response to these questions, we can discern two camps in a political cleavage. And I use the term two camps to follow chronicler Mohammed Bayram in the 1850s in the Regency of Tunis, who used the word fariqain in Arabic. I use sometimes acronistically the labels liberal and conservative to capture the gist of what these two camps stand for. In real life, we also find, of course, the labels Islamists versus secularists, but I avoid the term secularist because it implies a project of separation or neutrality. We also find inflammatory or self-serving labels such as reactionaries versus progressives, enlightened, nominal Muslims, and so on. All these labels are contextual, and I do not pay undue attention to them. Also, the liberal and conservative stances in the cleavage are not fixed, but depend on the status quo, which evolves as a result of a tug of war between the two camps. Hence, these stances evolve through time and vary from place to place. We can find it in authoritarian and democratic contexts. Most contemporary authoritarian governments have imposed what I call an authoritarian synthesis of liberal and conservative stances. So what do liberals and conservatives want? Conservatives argue for a thicker state custodianship of Islam, whereas liberals advocate for a thinner one, that is, for fewer Islamic constraints on the state. Conservatives also argue for a more munificent state custodianship of Islam. They aim to expand the place of Islam in governance by increasing state-funded religious provisions, whereas their liberals' adversaries aim to decrease them. On the issues of the strength of the state's custodianship of Islam, the picture is more complicated and contextual. Liberals who argue for a thinner and less munificent state custodianship of Islam also often advocate for a stronger one, that is for its coercive implementation, and would in that case be better described as illiberal progressives. For instance, they often advocate for specifying and enforcing a correct Islam, and for imposing limits on their conservative political adversaries' freedoms of expression and association, for example, by outlawing the mixing of religion and politics. However, they seldom argue for separating Islam from the state or for state neutrality, converging in this regard with conservatives. On the other hand, conservatives generally support mixing religion and politics, since they often argue that policies should be derived from religious doctrine. They might call for a weaker state custodianship of Islam when facing state repression, but they might advocate for a stronger one if the state abides by an Islamic philosophy of governance, that is, to their liking. Importantly, this political cleavage preceded the emergence of organized Islamist movements, such as the Muslim Brothers, founded in 1928 in Egypt. They did not create it, spoiling a so-called liberal age, as conventional wisdom has it. I show in chapter 4 of the book that the Muslim Brothers, in fact, joined a pre-existing political battle about the role of Islam in governance, and that they reappropriated pre-existing conservative tropes. For instance, Islam is the religion of, Islam is religion and state, or the Quran is our constitution, in a context of mass politics. How does this contrast with received wisdom? Political scientists and historians often reduce the relationship between Islam and politics to the antagonism between organized Islamist movements and supposedly secular states. They focus almost exclusively on such movements when studying Islam and politics and ignore other protagonists. They do not replace Islamist movements in a long and broad genealogy of ideas. Therefore, they often strive to explain the emergence of Islamist movements by socio-economic dysfunctions. By socio-economic dysfunctions. And instead, I find that the Islamist project, that is the expansion of the role of Islam in governance, is in continuity with a conservative tradition of political thought. When the role of Islam in the state is acknowledged, it is assumed to be primarily for legitimacy, identity, or symbolic purposes. Instead, the state custodianship of Islam as a principle is a concrete state duty. E.g., in 1923 Egypt, it is officially declared, and I quote, one of the accepted necessities of public order. ضرورة من ضرورات النظام العام المسلم بها. To be sure, it can be used as a political tool in sometimes shameless instrumentalization of the cleavage. And there are some examples in chapter 2 of my book, which is set in colonial Tunisia and at independence. Some attribute the politicization of Islam to colonization, nationalism, the formation of nation states, and modernization, as if political contentions about the role of Islam in governance did not exist before these modern developments. Intellectual historians go slightly further back, but often see a puzzling bifurcation from reformist thinkers to Muslim fundamentalists, e.g. from Muhammad Abdu to Rashid Rida. Why? They rarely focus on debates on governance with multiple sides involved, e.g. they often only attend to liberal stances, and they rarely focus on debates in real loci of deliberation, e.g. they often look at writings by specific intellectual and political actors. What I hope the book shows is that focusing on a specific issue, the role of Islam in governance, and following the history of intellectual and political disagreements on this issue in real loci of deliberation, hence my choice to study constitutional debates, tells us a different story. Rather than a puzzling bifurcation, we uncover an enduring political battle that I describe in the book through a number of examples. Cultural anthropologists claim that the Middle East has become subject to a ubiquitous and hegemonic Western liberal secularism in modern times, and that modern Middle Eastern states are therefore secular. They posit, but do not explain nor document, a rupture in modern times. They claim that religious institutions have been annihilated in modern times. We will see that this is not the case. Some even claim that religious minorities are a modern invention, and that Western liberal secularism is responsible for sectarianism and for the discrimination of religious minorities in the modern Middle East. I find instead that in modern times, as in pre-modern times, the issue of the organization and management of religious differences and hierarchies under a Muslim state have constituted a political and legal issue. Let me now turn to the organization of the book. In chapter 1-3, I examine the long history of constitutional debates in Tunisia. Its constitutional history is one of the oldest and longest among Muslim-majority polities. This allows for the study of the constitutional debates about Islam in governance in a particularly wide variety of contexts: pre-colonial, colonial, independent nation-state after a fight for independence, authoritarian governance, and democratic transition followed by a return to authoritarianism. Since Tunisia is often deemed one of the most religiously neutral polities of the Middle East, it is a particularly illuminating case to sustain my argument for the continuity of the state's custodianship of Islam as a preferred religion in most Muslim-majority polities and the persistence of a broad agreement about the necessity of this principle. How exceptional is Tunisia in this regard? To answer that, I analyze constitutional debates about Islam and governance that took place in the 1920s, a period often described as a liberal age, and contrasted with later periods of so-called revival or Islamization, when several Middle Eastern polities in the Mashriq first drafted constitutions for their newly sovereign or quasi-sovereign states. 1920 Greater Syria and 1926 Lebanon are distinctive because of their large population of non-Muslims. They allow me to study the impact of the demographic weight of religious minorities on the role religion can play in governance and on the extent to which there can be a state-preferred religion. Also, 1923 Egypt is important because of its paradigmatic status in the historiography, but also because, as I indicated already, it allows for a re-evaluation of the Muslim Brothers' novelty, and because in 1922-23, there were deep debates about the tension between the state custodianship of Islam as a preferred religion on the one hand, and freedom of religion and equality regardless of religion on the other hand, in a country with about 10% non-Muslim Egyptians. I will not have time to delve into that part of the book, chapters 1-4. Let me just say that we can observe that as of 2010, all Muslim-majority Middle Eastern polities, except for already mentioned Lebanon, and including Turkey, despite its constitutionalization of laiklik, secularism, have a state-preferred religion, Islam. Overall, 88% of the population of Muslim-majority polities around the world and 99% in the Middle East live under a state that favors Islam. The fact that there are exceptions to this empirical regularity shows that the state having a preferred religion is not an inevitable or essential feature of Muslim-majority polities again. Moreover, this feature is not distinctive of these polities since 45% of other polities have a state-preferred religion. However, it is much more prevalent among Muslim-majority polities and especially so in the Middle East. What my analysis of constitutional debates since the 19th century shows is that this situation is not the result of a recent revival, but a long-standing concrete reality and aspiration. As a worldwide cross-sectional statistical analysis of the factors that might influence the odds of a state having a preferred religion strongly suggests that it is a variable of choice, subject to certain constraints, notably the demographic weight of religious minorities. Neither GDP per capita, average years of schooling, nor an index of political rights significantly influences these odds, whereas the demographic weight of the religious majority does. It increases them in a substantial and statistically significant way. As I show in the first four chapters of the book, the anxieties of the majority of being governed by the minority as such more often than not trump those of the minorities of not having their rights protected. Let me now turn to chapter 5, and I want to zoom on that particular part of the book to the concrete implementation of the state custodianship of Islam. To do that, I estimate public religious expenditures, i.e. expenditures on public religious provisions, that is religious goods made available to the public free of charge, not religious goods produced or distributed within the family. I do so since the late 19th century or early 20th centuries in four countries, Tunisia, Egypt, Morocco, and Turkey, plus an incursion into 1730 Tunisia and 10th century Iraq. And I analyze debates about their extent, content, and form of delivery. These four countries have significant historical, political, and socio-economic dissimilarities, as illustrated by their human and economic development trajectories, their contrasting histories of foreign occupation, and their contrasting political systems over time, such as monarchic, republican, democratic, and authoritarian. This notwithstanding, a similar picture emerges, which I will talk about in a bit. Public religious provisions can be categorized as infrastructure and personnel dedicated to Islamic worship, Islamic education, that is, specialized Islamic tracts, i.e. madrasas or modern incarnations thereof, whose primary purpose is the teaching of the Islamic sciences, and Islamic instruction in modern schools, i.e. new schools created to teach imported European knowledge. There is also infrastructure and personnel dedicated to Sharia justice, and then public works and assistance when delivered in an Islamic form, i.e. through public waqfs, that is, Islamic endowments. And I estimate aggregate public religious expenditures using printed and archival material, including yearly fine-grained state budgets, not restricting myself to ministries of religious affairs, as is commonly done, and including Islamic instruction in modern schools, using the fraction of the curriculum that is devoted to it and the percentage of enrollments Muslim students represent. I also use yearly madrasa and public waqf's fine-grained budgets when they are kept separate from the central state budget. I make sure to disaggregate expenditures on public religious provisions from those that go toward operating, maintaining, and managing their revenue-generating assets. These are significant and at times represent the bulk of total waqf's expenditures. I also estimate enrollments of Muslim students in state and state-subsidized schools, both madrasas and modern schools, as well as hours of Islamic instruction dispensed in both. I do this for the same four countries over a slightly longer period. Note here that I am eschewing the conventional dichotomy traditional and religious versus modern and secular schooling. Instead, I track the aggregate number of hours of Islamic instruction in both modern schools and madrasas. There is a summarized data appendix at the end of the book that explains what sources I used and how I estimated these quantities, if you are interested. So what are my findings? First of all, I find that public religious provisions have mainly been a state affair and that civil society's contribution is smaller. It is often claimed that private voluntary associations provide large amounts of public provisions in the Middle East, especially in the religious domains, a claim that often accompanies narratives about an alleged withdrawal of the state. We will see that there is no evidence of withdrawal of the state in terms of religious expenditures. On this slide, you can see that even in Egypt, which has one of the oldest and most important private associations tradition, the relative contribution of these associations to public religious provisions has been very small, especially after deducting government aid and user fees. In addition, associations are usually not only significantly state-subsidized in cash and other forms of aid, but they also are tightly regulated, guided, and leveraged by the state. In the book, I provide analogous estimates for the contributions of private waqfs and Sufi brotherhoods in the first half of the 20th century. Second, the state's financial support can be decentralized via public waqfs, which used to be prevalent, or centralized via direct payments from the state budget, which is prevalent today. However, centralization waves or efforts are certainly not distinctive of the modern period. Public provisions by public waqfs have been very much a state affair. they have been regulated and managed under the purview of the ruler. To be sure, they were funded not only by rulers and state officials, but also by private, that is, non-state individuals. However, their contribution was smaller, as I show in the book. We can see here that the public works used to provide a large fraction of public religious provisions, whereas today they are essentially delivered through direct state expenditures, that is, from the state treasuries. In other words, the state sustains religious institutions and their missions, whatever the institutional form or arrangement. As the General Secretary of the Tunisian government wrote in 1950, and I quote, "It is irrelevant whether the budget of the public works is balanced or not, since the main thing is to know whether it exhibits a surplus or a deficit, so that the higher authority may use the surpluses or cover the shortfall as is its right." This illustrates not only that religious provisions are a state affair, but also that they will be supplied whatever the circumstances and means of delivery. And more broadly, the state provides its support on its own terms, since it reorganizes religious institutions, such as when Nasser massively expanded the scope and scale of Al-Azhar after 1961. It sometimes marginalizes or eliminates some institutions, such as when Tunisia outlawed religious endowments, public and private, after independence, and it reprioritizes religious expenditures. Let me give you a small example of reprioritization of religious expenditures. In 1848, Tunis, in the context of the reorganization of education, the ruler introduced a new category of professors called second-class professors at the Zaytuna, the madrasa of the Grand Mosque, you can see here, and increased their salaries. He used the surpluses of waqfs dedicated to the recitation of prayers in praise of the Prophet in the same Grand Mosque. However, it must have been insufficient because we are told by Ibn al-Khuja that with time, the prayers were forgotten and the two professors who used to recite them joined the rest of the class, unquote. So let me note here that such reprioritizations and reorganizations of Islamic institutions more broadly are, of course, not distinctive of the modern period. So these frequent state interventions create political tensions and ambivalence. You have on the one side the ulama, who want both autonomy and state financial support. They lament state control and the alleged hoarding of the real or imagined wealth of the waqfs. They also sustain the fiction of a past autonomy, self-sufficiency, and munificence of the Islamic endowments, but at the same time, they want to be paid directly from the state treasury, not the waqfs. As for state officials, they seek to control religious institutions and support the fiction of their autonomy to keep the ulama at a safe distance from politics and to better manage the expectations of the Muslim community as to the munificence of the state custodianship of Islam. And where the waqfs have persisted, even when small, they help the state support the fiction of autonomy, self-sufficiency, and munificence of religious institutions. For instance, Moroccan Islamic endowments' net revenues have only contributed about 5% of state religious expenditures in the last decades. But their accounts are hidden from public view, whereas public religious provisions, mainly supported by direct payments from the state budget, are advertised as coming from the waqfs, as in this flashy brochure with a monarch as the main protagonist, surrounded by ulama and officials during the Ramadan lessons in the king's palace. Let us now turn to the extent and evolution of public religious expenditures. First, public religious expenditures are relatively small, especially in relation to GDP, but on display as an important duty. This might come as a surprise, since scholars and political actors alike have often vastly exaggerated the economic importance of religious endowments, and especially the amount of public religious provisions they use to dispense. Second, public religious expenditures may have decreased as a fraction of total state expenditures in the long durée. third, they drastically expanded in per capita real terms, i.e. adjusted for inflation, in the modern period with the drastic expansion of the size and reach of the state, especially in education. And that is central in my argument. Fourth, there are disputes between the two camps we talked about in the political cleavage about the munificence of the state custodianship of Islam, and therefore short-term fluctuations that are often the result of tugs of war between the two camps. These fluctuations certainly feed the narratives of each side of this cleavage. In his Muqaddima, Ibn Khaldun writes that the share of religious officials' pay in the ruler's budget is generally small. He uses the term qalil, since the ruler, and I quote, gives them their share in accordance with the general need and the demand of the population for them. He recounts that it was only after showing a skeptical contemporary stray leaves from the account books of the government offices in the palace of Abbasid Caliph al-Ma'mun that he was able to convince his interlocutor. And I have to say that my experience was not too dissimilar from his when working on this topic. And I hope I can convince you. As for the importance of the religious professions and institutions, Ibn Khaldun relates them, and I quote again, to the ruler's duty to look after the public interest, masalih. So let me show you a few graphs to illustrate what I have just explained. So as you can see here, as a percentage of GDP, state religious expenditures are and have been relatively small. My estimates for 18th and 19th century Tunisia are in the 0.3 to 0.4% range, close to where we are today. In the 20th century, they have fluctuated, but ranged between, for instance, close to 0% in 1940s Turkey, the result of the Kemalist reforms, to 1% in 2015 Egypt, after which they decreased under President Sisi. That is also where they are in 2020 Morocco, the result of more attention to religious infrastructure by the Moroccan monarchy after the Casablanca terrorist attacks of 2003. You can also see that in Tunisia, they peaked during colonization at the eve of independence and that Bourguiba's reforms halved them, whereas in Morocco, they doubled in the decade after independence. Also of note are the fluctuations in Egypt. We see a peak in the 1930s, a trough right before the officers' coup, followed by a pickup under Nasser, although he is conventionally thought of as a secularizer. To put these numbers in perspective, in the US, expenditures on public religious provisions amount to 2% of GDP, but civil society is the main contributor, of course. Finally, in this metric, state religious expenditures pretty much continuously increase in Turkey since the mid-1940s, with some reversals in the 1980s and 1990s. However, note that as we will see in the next slide, as a percentage of total state expenditures, they are today slightly below where they were in the early days of the Republic. So we're going to move to from state religious expenditures as a percentage of GDP to state religious expenditures as a percentage of total state expenditures. So if we now examine state religious expenditures as a percentage of total state expenditures, we can see for Tunisia that since the late 19th century, they have been a lot smaller than they were in the 18th century. It seems that in the 19th century, they have decreased relative to other state expenditures to make room for them. On the other hand, in per capita real terms, that is adjusted for inflation, I display them here in purchasing power parity adjusted 1990 US dollars. They have massively increased, and the majority of this increase occurred in the 20th and 21st century, especially after 1950. We therefore see a double crunch story, a story of relative secularization seen from the point of view of the state, combined with a story of absolute expansion of religion seen from the point of view of society, that is, the individuals receiving religious provisions. The fluctuations in state religious expenditures also show how fickle an Islamic ranking using this metric would be. In per capita real terms, in 1955, Turkey came last and Tunisia first. In 2020, this ranking was reversed. However, as remarkable as these fluctuations and reversals are, they are dwarfed by the massive increase of state religious expenditures in per capita real terms in the last century or so. So let us now try to understand why we may have this two-pronged long-term trend. To do this, let us turn to the evolution of the size of the economy measured by GDP and of the state measured by its total expenditures in the long duration. I have borrowed the expression uneven centuries from Sefket Pamuk's 2018 study of the economic performance of Turkey since 1820. We see two periods. First, the 19th century, during which the size of the state as a percentage of GDP started to expand significantly. I show it here for Tunisia, where it increased more than fivefold from about 2% to 11% of GDP, but during which GDP per capita in real terms only increased slightly across the region. Second, the 20th century, when the size of the state as a percentage of GDP and GDP per capita in real terms both drastically increased across the region. Let us now see how our story of relative decrease and absolute expansion of state religious expenditures can be interpreted in relation to these two uneven centuries. During the first period, the 19th century, only displayed here for the case of Tunisia, state religious expenditures as a percentage of total state expenditures decreased due to the significant increase of the size of the state we have seen in the previous slide. But in per capita real terms, they essentially remain constant. As it increased its fiscal capacity, the state continued to provide the same amount of religious provisions per capita, some sort of minimal threshold, and gave priority to its non-religious expenditures given the economic challenges of the time. It is as if hard choices had to be made in the face of new needs of a secular nature during the Tanzimat in a context of low economic growth. This is a hypothesis, of course, and it would require more archival work to fully understand what happened in Tunisia and to generalize the study to other countries, given that they experienced a similar trajectory of expansion of their state's fiscal capacity. However, the second period, the 20th century, is one in which, for the four countries I studied, state religious expenditures fluctuated within a relatively small range as a percentage of total state religious expenditures, and state religious expenditures greatly increased per capita real terms, especially after the 1950s, as if there was now enough economic growth and a double whammy of expansion of GDP per capita and expansion of state fiscal capacity to invest in religious expenditures. As we will see, this massive expansion has been in great part related to the expansion of Islamic education, and it has often been seen by policymakers as contributing to human development. As you can see, in the beginning of the period I studied, state religious expenditures were mostly devoted to Islamic worship, close to two-thirds. They are now mostly devoted to Islamic education, also close to two-thirds. This is due to the massive increase in Muslim student enrollments per capita in our four countries, which all follow the same trend, with some leading others. This massive expansion of school enrollments, coupled with the continuous presence of Islamic instruction in curricula, except in Turkey, as you can see there, in the 1940s, led to a massive increase in state expenditures on madrasas and Islamic education in modern schools in per capita real terms and as a fraction of state religious expenditures, which is displayed here. As we already saw, this fraction converged at the end of the period to about two-thirds in our four countries, the rest being essentially devoted to worship, infrastructure, and personnel. If we now unravel state expenditures in specialized Islamic tracts from those devoted to Islamic instruction in modern schools, this is where we are now. In some countries, such as Tunisia and Morocco, Islamic education expenditures are mostly devoted to Islamic instruction in modern schools, whereas in others, such as Egypt and Turkey, they are mostly devoted to specialized Islamic tracts, Al-Azhar in Egypt, and Khatib schools, Ilahiyat, and Islamic institutes in Turkey. Since the establishment of modern schools in the 19th century, the extent of specialized Islamic tracts in terms of expenditures or enrollments has been an important object of debates. After independence in Tunisia, for instance, President Bourguiba and his allies, when radically shrinking the enrollments at the Zaytouna, argued that it was an archaic institution and that the French colonial authorities had been at fault in giving it too many resources. Similarly, debates about the fraction of the curriculum Islamic instruction should constitute in modern schools, and hence the extent of state expenditures it entails, have been the object of vigorous debates in all four countries before, during, and after foreign occupation, where it occurred. Now, if we look at the history of enrollments in specialized Islamic tracts as a percentage of all enrollments for Muslim students, we can see that until the end of the 19th century, madrasas provided the bulk of state and state-subsidized education, with Egypt being much more advanced in the mid-19th century in its development of modern schools than Tunisia, in part because it repurposed specialized Islamic tracts. Also, we can see that the share of enrollments in specialized Islamic tracts decreased since then, with the development of modern schooling to become insignificant in all four countries in the 1970s. However, starting in the 1970s, we see that in Turkey, and especially Egypt, they increased to reach almost 10% of total school enrollments in 2020. In sum, it is clear that by the early 20th century, the ulama, those who teach in the specialized Islamic tracts, had lost the battle of education. Although, after the 70s, they have been given more space in the education system in Egypt, which I studied for my PhD dissertation and my first book, and somewhat in Turkey, in fits and starts. As a result, in the 20th century, most of the Islamic education hours dispensed annually, and virtually all of them in today's Tunisia and Morocco have been dispensed in modern schools, as you can see in this chart, which is a mirror image of the previous one. And as a result of the massive expansion in school enrollments, the annual hours of Islamic instruction dispensed per capita has massively increased across the board, despite significant fluctuations and country-to-country differences. It is remarkable that this massive expansion has occurred while the percentage of school hours of Islamic instruction dispensed in modern schools and specialized Islamic tracts combined has decreased, as you see here. This decrease is due to the fact that the education as a whole has secularized. We have less Islamic education hours in modern schools as a fraction of their curriculum. I have not displayed that chart, only the combined fraction. And we have fewer enrollments in specialized Islamic tracts relative to modern schools, as we saw. Note that the first data point displayed on this graph for Turkey comes after a drastic reduction in the share of Islamic instruction in modern schools and after the closure of the madrasa system. Before the Republic, it would look more similar to the other countries, but this is a project I have to carry out after, in the coming years, hopefully. So the secularization of education did not go without debates, even before the introduction of modern schools. At the Zaytouna in 1871, as we saw in the previous slide, only about 30% of the lessons were on religious topics. This is an excerpt from an official report on the Zaytouna published in the Official Gazette of Tunisia in 1871 that complains that there is too much grammar. 66 lessons out of 148, whereas there are only 38 lessons in Islamic law and one lesson in Hadith. So the debates, you know, was there and has continued over the years. So in a nutshell, the history of Islamic education in state and state-subsidized schools follow that of state religious expenditures. We see a secularization of the education system. The share of Islamic instruction has decreased relative to other subjects, and the bulk of Islamic instruction is dispensed in modern schools, while the per capita exposure to Islamic instruction has massively increased. What can we conclude from all of this? From the material point of view, the state custodianship of Islam is well entrenched, contrary to those who claim that Islamic institutions have been annihilated. It is also vigorously discussed as to its extent and content, often polarizing further the cleavage on Islam in governance that I described more fully in the first part of this presentation. In fact, the state custodianship of Islam has massively expanded, in per capita state religious expenditures and per capita hours of Islamic instruction, thanks to the expansion of education. However, this absolute expansion has taken place despite a relative secularization, with the decrease of the percentage of state religious expenditures and of the percentage of Islamic instruction in the education system, since the state has increased its secular endeavors as well. To be sure, the form of delivery of public religious provisions has changed. Waqfs are much less prevalent today, and there are more modern schools and madrasas, and there might be nostalgia about this, but we should not confuse this transformation with the secularization of the state and society. One important aspect of the story I told you today is that choices have been made. Islamic instruction must be preserved in the public school system, and worship infrastructure and personnel must be financially supported by the state. These choices have kept the state custodianship of Islam alive. And mechanistic effects, such as those resulting from the unprecedented expansion in its magnitude of the size of the state and from mass education, have in fact solidified it and have given it a new scale. And we see rich and vigorous debates around the long historical cleavage on the state custodianship of Islam's thickness, strength, and munificence, with mass politics giving to the debate a new scale starting in the 1920s, 1930s. We should study, I think, and historicize these debates and cleavages, if possible, by studying all sides in actual loci of deliberation. In terms of policy implications, I would say that it is important to keep the debate alive, preferably under democratic conditions, and not predict that either side will moderate its stances or fade away. Thank you.